The dissolution of a marriage can be emotionally charged, especially when children are involved. Now researchers are discovering that what they have traditionally called high-conflict divorces are often cases of domestic violence and child abuse. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about what this can mean for abuse survivors and their children are author of the book, Invisible Chains, Overcoming Coercive Control in Your Intimate Relationship, and senior lecturer at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Lisa Fontes, and Child Maltreatment Policy Resource Center senior law and policy analyst, Pamela Miller. Thank you both so much for being here today.
No problem. Thank you for having us.
Lisa, many people go through divorces. Many divorces can be difficult. What are the best ways to determine if domestic violence or child abuse are part of a divorce proceeding?
Well, you look for the evidence. So there may be, first of all, does one party or the other or both claim that there was domestic violence and child abuse? Most divorces are settled reasonably amicably. So it's a relatively small portion that are contested. There may not be evidence in terms of witnesses, but there may not be calls to the police. There may be medical visits where someone did not declare that the injury was due to physical abuse. But there's also a form of domestic violence called coercive control, and that may or may not include physical violence. So if one party isolates the other, verbally abuses them, sexually abuses them, financially abuses them, and mistreats them in other ways, monitors their activities, that is also considered domestic violence. And there may be other kinds of evidence for that kind of domestic violence, such as hidden cameras or monitoring your partner's internet activity.
Can that be more difficult for the survivor of that kind of coercive control to report? Do survivors always recognize when that's happening to them, Lisa?
Well, the first problem is that most states still don't have laws concerning coercive control, but 7 states do, and a lot of other states are in the process of putting laws on the books regarding coercive control. But you've put your finger on something really important. A lot of people who are being victimized by coercive control feel that something is wrong and there are things they don't like, but they don't necessarily connect the dots to call it coercive control, which is a specific form of abuse of an intimate partner. Somebody who abuses their partner and mistreats them in those ways is also apt to mistreat their child. Not necessarily right away, but the person who lacks empathy with their partner, who tries to control and dominate them, eventually will use the same kinds of tactics with their children.
Pamela, how often is domestic violence or abuse a factor in divorce cases? Are there good statistics? Is there good data about that?
I don't think that there's good data about that as far as a precise number. What Lisa said is correct, that most divorces are resolved amicably and not with a contested trial. In my expert witness work, I see only cases where there are allegations of spousal abuse or child abuse, and courts are using terms like high conflict divorce to describe this phenomenon, which is a little bit faulty because it sort of implies that both parties are equally at fault for whatever disagreement there is. And in cases of family violence or coercive control, there is typically one person, the abuser, that is causing problems for the other parent or for the children. And so using other names like situations of coercive control, cases of family violence, is preferable to saying high conflict divorce.
Sure. And Pamela, you mentioned that those are really the only cases that you're involved in as an expert witness. So how common is that? Is that something that you see once a month, once a year, more common?
Oh my goodness. I get probably 4 or 5 calls a week
Oh my gosh.
Asking for my services. I'm only able to take on a small portion of those. So I try to focus on the cases where I think I can have the biggest impact, where there is some helpful evidence, and where there really just needs, the court just needs reassurance from an expert that there is evidence indicating spousal abuse or child abuse in the context of the divorce.
Lisa, it has to be so frightening for a parent who's escaping an abusive relationship, whatever form that takes, to think about how a court will view the case. What can parents do to protect themselves and their children from an abusive partner when they're initiating a divorce or going through a divorce?
It is absolutely terrifying. And your question reminds me of one mother who said to me, "I got a protective order. So the court recognizes that I, at 40 years old, need protection from this person. And yet they are obligating me to give my child, who's only 1 year old, to their father, who is abusive and dangerous." And they were, you know, concerned about the child's safety. So what can a parent do? If a parent, they can seek a protective order. The first step is a temporary protective order for themselves and possibly for their child, depending on the circumstances, and then seek to make that order permanent. They should also seek temporary parenting orders. And the first step is really to contact your local domestic violence agency and work out a safety plan. That doesn't mean you're necessarily going to go to a shelter, and it doesn't mean you're necessarily even separating if that's not something you want to do. But figure out how they will help you. Your local domestic violence agency will help you figure out how to keep yourself and your children safe.
We're talking about when domestic violence and child abuse are factors in divorce cases that sometimes get labeled high conflict. Do you have questions or comments? Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Lisa, you just mentioned protective orders. I guess I wonder, can abuse survivors get in trouble with authorities for contacting their abusers if there is a protective order? I mean, that seems like something that can vary state by state, isn't it?
That, unfortunately, that does vary state by state. The protected party should not get in trouble because it's the restrained party who should be getting in trouble. But I can't generalize across states because it really does vary state by state. And sometimes the domestic abusers will do their best to entice their ex into contact or pressure them into contact, maybe withholding financial support unless they agree to some kind of contact, in an effort to say, see, this person is not actually afraid of me.
Well, Pamela, sometimes people who are survivors of abuse can try to initiate contact to kind of gauge safety, right? Talk about some of those circumstances.
Absolutely. So especially in cases where there has been child abuse by one parent, the protective parent may desire contact with the abuser to gauge the safety of their children on any given day. So let's say, you know, a father is supposed to get custody of or visitation with the children on Friday afternoons. An abused mother may want to speak with father to figure out, you know, is he angry with the children today? Does he seem like he's at risk of being abusive today? Is he drinking or using substances? Is he planning to drive the children after using substances? It can be reassuring to a parent of abused children to know that their former abuser has been is calm or they're in their good favor, those types of things. So it's really not a matter of, you know, what courts may say, oh, this parent wasn't really afraid because they initiated contact. They may initiate contact because of how afraid they are.
Well, and Pamela, are there sometimes mixed signals that survivors get from police, too? Do police ever say, hey, you keep contacting this person, we can't come over here every time this person violates a protective order because you keep contacting them? Can that become a risk in some of these cases?
It can certainly become a risk that whether it's police or the courts or, you know, a custody evaluator, a guardian ad litem for the children, all trying trying to assess what's really going on with this family, it may signal them that that the parent protected by the protection order is just not actually afraid. And so there may be accusations then that a parent sought a protective order to gain an advantage in the divorce. The opposite is really true. People get divorced because of spousal abuse and child abuse rather than having a normal, healthy family, maybe with some conflict, and then fabricating. We do have statistics on the rates of fabrication and who is likely to fabricate stories of spousal or child abuse in a divorce. And it's pretty rare. So false allegations of spousal abuse and child abuse occur at about the same rate that all crimes are falsely reported, between 2% and 5%. And we know actually that non-custodial fathers are the most likely parent to fabricate abuse. A custodial mother reporting abuse of herself or her children is actually least likely to be fabricating.
Hmm. Important information there. Lisa, what can the courts do, or what would you like to see them do to draw these distinctions, to try to get better at determining why someone who survived abuse has contacted their abuser and not kind of misinterpret what's going on there?
Well, I want to focus for a second, if you don't mind, on litigation abuse. The courts have a really important role in figuring out when somebody may be using the courts or abusing the courts to punish their ex, so that not every court action, every charge of contempt is entered in good faith. They're often entered as a way to punish their ex. So courts need to keep tabs on this. And that's part of the legislation in some states, and I think up and coming, is to get people protection from this litigation abuse. I know someone whose ex was an attorney, and she has had over 300 allegations of or court hearings that she had to attend due to her ex using the courts abusively. This is a form of domestic violence post-separation, to use the courts in this way. So the courts need to make sure that they're not being manipulated in this way. You'll also often increasingly see domestic abusers trying to claim that their victim is actually an abuser. We call that DARVO, which stands for deny, attack, reverse, victim, and offender, where an abuser will accuse their victim of actually being the abuser and sometimes manufacture evidence to support that accusation.
We are going to continue this conversation after a short break, and later in the program, we'll discuss the future of office space locally. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about when domestic violence and child abuse are part of high-conflict divorces. My guests are author of the book, Invisible Chains, Overcoming Coercive Control in Your Intimate Relationship, Lisa Fontes, and Child Maltreatment Policy Resource Center Senior Law and Policy Analyst, Pamela Miller. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Everin. Thanks so much for your call. What is your question?
Well, thank you for accepting my call. I really appreciate that for your time, and I really appreciate that for the great topic that you bring it up, you brought it up. And, well, I would like to give out some comment about the divorcing. Well, I had an experience, and so it shouldn't be that much easy to either parents just walk up the courthouse and get a protection order against each other. It should be somewhere before you go to the court and talk about it, whatever your accusation, and you could go from there. But my situation, and I had my children's mother, she just walked up the court 4 times and she got the protection order, temporary protection order against me because she was going to go to vacation or she had a different plan going on. She just went to court up there and she got a protection order. Mm.
I'm going to put you on hold there, Everin. I see where you're going, but I know we're getting, we have a limited amount of time for this conversation. Pamela, what's your experience? How easy or difficult is it for one parent to get a temporary protective order against another parent? And if the other parent feels like that's happening, you know, for a false reason, what kind of recourse do they have?
Well, I certainly feel like courts do their best to evaluate the level of evidence that's required in any individual case to see if they if there is sort of a case on its face, a prima facie case of domestic violence when they issue temporary orders. Temporary orders are temporary. They go away pending a full trial. So the person being accused of abuse has a right to appear, to have an attorney, to call witnesses on their own behalf, submit documents on their own behalf, and the court will have that full trial to determine whether or not protection orders can become permanent.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yes, I sympathize in some ways with the caller because their temporary protective orders are relatively easy to get, but they will not be extended if there isn't good evidence. So the problem that I see most often these days is people who are domestic abusers taking out temporary protective orders against their victims. Judges are in a really tight spot because of the way the laws are written, that the temporary protective orders are relatively easy to get. And I should say that protective orders are not the whole solution, and that's why it's so important to speak to a domestic violence advocate at your local agency. And, you know, they're not for everybody. For some people, they work, they make a lot of sense. For other people, they don't.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Evan. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling and for listening. We also got an email from Cynthia. Cynthia emails, during this conversation, the abusers are mostly him. My experience has been the woman was the abuser. Any comments on that? What do you run into in your practice, Pamela? Do you have thoughts on that for Cynthia?
Well, certainly anybody can be an abuser. I think numbers-wise, I'm mostly seeing male partners as abusers with heterosexual female partners as the victims. But not every case is like that. I have worked on cases where there is sort of a reversal there, and it can get very complicated because many times a male abuser is accusing his female victim of being the actual abuser, as Lisa talked about. But if we look at the numbers, it is primarily an issue of men abusing women.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about this, Lisa. How can a custodial parent balance a requirement from the court or maybe even a personal desire for their child to have a relationship with a parent who has been maybe previously abusive to them while also maintaining safety for themselves and the children? I mean, I imagine there are times when a parent thinks, well, that child still needs to have a relationship with the dad or the mom, whatever the case may be. What's that balancing act look like?
I'm so glad you raised that issue. What I see so often is you call them custodial parent. Let's just say a protective parent. So someone who has not been acted abusively towards their child, but who has been partnered with someone who acted abusively towards them and possibly the child. And they often stay with the abuser because they do want that person, the second parent, in their child's life. And they stay with the abuser until they feel like it's untenable, and then they separate. And they typically would like to see some sort of healthy relationship happen. From my perspective, the burden then really the burden is on the person who has behaved abusively. They need to recognize their actions. They need to admit to their actions. They need to get involved in a batterer intervention program. Anger management is not the same and is not adequate, but into a certified batterer intervention program or interpersonal violence intervention program. The good ones are 26 to 52 weeks, where they will come to understand their inappropriate behavior. And the best programs also have a parenting component that they can do as a follow-up. And there are programs, the Emerge program out of Boston, for instance, has a wonderful online program. And so when they admit to their problematic behavior, then that's the first step towards learning to become a safe parent. But unfortunately, so often what you'll see is domestic abusers who fail to admit to their abusive actions and rather do their best to destroy their ex post-separation, even when that means hurting their children. In other words, their determination to hit their ex, hurt their ex, is more important than their desire to help their children. And David Adams came up with a name for that. It's called spiteful disregard. Spiteful disregard. So that's where one parent is willing to harm their children in order to get back at their ex.
Lisa, I'm glad you brought up spiteful disregard because I did want to get into that. Have you seen disputes over things like vaccines when it comes to spiteful disregard?
I've seen disputes over vaccines. I've seen disputes over a lot of things. So, the abusive parent will frequently not allow their child to see a therapist or will not allow their child to have a psychological or educational assessment. The abusive parent might shave their child's head, knowing that that will make the child embarrassed and feel awkward in school, but they'll do it to get back at their ex. Or they will inadequately feed their child when they have parenting time. So the child goes back to the protective parent famished. They may deliberately expose their child to scary movies or even pornography, again, because they know it will upset the other parent. So their parenting is severely hampered because their determination to get back at their ex is just much bigger and more important to them than their desire to parent.
Pamela, that makes me think about neglect. I mean, what about if a parent isn't physically abusing a child, but seems ill-equipped, isn't feeding the child, or is otherwise neglecting what people would think of as parental responsibilities? How does that fit into this conversation?
It can fit into two ways. Neglect can be malicious and intentional, the way Lisa is describing in spiteful disregard. Neglect can also come as a result of poverty, lack of parenting skills, lack of information about how to handle children. And so it's really important, I think, to figure out kind of what are some of the underlying causes there so that services for the family can be appropriately matched. Is this a parent that just needs some parenting classes and to learn about ages and stages with children? Or is this something being intentionally done to harm their child, either to get back at the other parent or just to continue to control the family with power, domination, and coercive control?
One of the most horrific outcomes of situations like this are when a child dies at the hands of a parent or parental figure. The Center for Judicial Excellence has tracked nearly 1,000 children killed by a parent or parental figure over a number of years. That's over the last more than a decade. That's including four Ohio children killed by their fathers in 2023 and one child killed by his mother in a murder-suicide that same year. Pamela, how difficult is it to track how often these cases result in just serious harm or death?
I think that when we look at and study child fatalities, we're primarily looking at underlying cause. So, was this malicious neglect where the child wasn't fed and they died as a result? Was this physical abuse where there was a head injury and the child died? But I feel like we don't necessarily track. Was this in the context of a quote unquote high conflict divorce where the parent was doing spiteful disregard? That is something that would be beneficial to track in child fatality studies and the review boards that look at their local child fatalities. So it's very relevant to the discussion today to understand what are the primary factors motivating a parent to intentionally take the life of their child.
And if I can add one thing, I think we'd also don't track adequately was there domestic violence? Because domestic violence, one person perpetrating domestic violence against a partner often is the one of the early signals of something really bad to come, whether that's a mass shooting or mass killing, or whether that's the killing of a child. And so there is a correlation there, and we need to do a better job tracking that.
Lisa, just very quickly, what more would you like to see the courts do in divorce proceedings where domestic violence and child abuse could be factors?
I would like to see them step in early and offer services to parents. I would like to see them understand that that someone who is a domestic abuser is not going to be able to parent their child well unless they get some serious intervention and they admit to their inappropriate behaviors. So that is really important. Otherwise, they may need supervised visits.
I've been talking with the author of the book Invisible Chains: Overcoming Coercive Control in Your Intimate Relationship, Lisa Aronson Fontes, and Child Maltreatment Policy Resource Center Senior Policy Analyst and Senior Law and Policy Analyst, I'm going to get this right, Pamela Miller. Thank you both so much for your time today. It's been such an important discussion.
Thank you for
having
me.
Pleasure to be here.
Up next, we'll discuss the future of office space in Greater Cincinnati. This is Cincinnati Edition.